The first scripture reading is Psalm 133, which David already talked a little bit about. How very good and pleasant it is when kindred live together in unity. It is like the precious oil on the head running down upon the beard, on the beard of Aaron, running down over the collar of his robes. It is like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion. For there the Lord ordained his blessing, life forevermore. The second reading is from Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 to 33. And both these readings are from the New Revised Standard Version. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But by this time, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning, he came walking toward them on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It's a ghost!" And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, Peter became frightened and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Thus ends the readings.
156 Sundays ago, I stood in the pulpit at Church of the Crossroads for the first time as your pastor. That was on the third week of third Sunday of August, just like this is the third Sunday of August. And you may not realize it, because I got to tell you, 156 weeks, 156 sermons, all of that sounds like quite a bit. And one of my biggest worries as a preacher is that I am going to run out of stories at some time. And then I'm going to start repeating myself. In fact, my guess is I have repeated so many stories already in those 156 weeks that I'm not even, that you all are probably beginning to number some of those stories. Numbering them like, okay, here's number story number one, this is what it's about, story number five over here, story number 49. And I know that if you begin to chat when we're on Zoom and say, "Okay, David, this is story number three," that maybe that's the way that we can shorten sermons, because I will just say number two and you all will know what it's all about, and then we'll move on. But the truth of the matter is, I really do live in fear that I'm just going to end up telling the same story, because I don't know if I have that many stories in my life or that many stories to tell. And the one that I'm about to tell, I'm afraid I may have told before, at least to some of you, but I felt that it made good sense to work for this sermon, so I'm going to do it again. So this story happens about 50 some odd, 50 plus years ago, when I am a sixth grader in school, having just returned to Hawaii from our family's 10 or 11th month sojourn in Montgomery, Alabama. And I've just returned to school, and one of the things that I get to choose to be a part of is the fifth and sixth grade choir. And I will say to you, I am thrilled that I get to be in the fifth and sixth grade choir. I was at that time a little bit of an exuberant child, and singing was a pretty good way, as a good outlet for some of that energy. So we gathered together, those of us that are in the fifth and sixth grade choir, in the music room, and the music teacher begins to play a song and has us sing along. And we're singing along until all of a sudden, abruptly, the music teacher stops. And she says, "Something's not right here." And then she says, I need to figure out what's wrong here. And she has us start singing again. She starts singing again, and I watch her, and she's attuning her ear to where the offense is coming from. And soon her eyes turned to the area of the room where I am and where others are singing. And soon her eyes turn right on me and she says, stop. And she points at me and she says, you are not singing this right at all. And I kind of took a gulp and she said, and I don't think you should be in choir, so you should probably leave now. Well, you can well imagine with that public humiliation in front of all of my friends there, that now I have been told that I am so bad at singing that I need to leave the room at that moment and not come back. The result of that is that not only for the longest time did I not sing in public ever again, but nor did I ever really sing to my own again for the longest time. I became painfully aware that at least according to everyone else in the world, I could not sing. I told myself I was tone deaf, and that tone deaf went along with the lack of rhythm that I had already told myself that I had. And so for most of the rest of my days, since that sixth grade class, I've been disproportionately self-conscious of every time I sing and completely convinced that every time that I would sing, people would cringe. Now I want you to fast forward from that sixth grade class experience, 50 years, and it's now 156 weeks ago, and I'm putting together my very first worship service and my very first sermon as your pastor at Church of the Crossroads. This is a big deal for me. I had just left the work that I was convinced, had convinced myself would be the work I would do until I retired at Camp Mokulei'i as the executive director. I was leaving a place, the North Shore Mokulei'i. It was a place where my spirit soared. And I was coming to be the pastor of the church that I had watched since I was a teenager and saw that this was the only church or the church that was the most woke, as we would say today, the most with the church that understood the gospel, that lived out the gospel in the ways that I believe that all churches should be. And this church had somehow called me to be their pastor. So whether I showed it or not, I was nervous. I wanted to make a good impression. I wanted it to go well. So on that very first Sunday, as your new pastor, when the call to worship ended, at the moment that we should be hearing the accompanist begin to play the first notes of the song that we would sing as our gathering song, instead, I stood up in the pulpit. And as I stood up, I straightened my back up. I said to myself, gave myself a little bit of a pep talk. I said, the adventure begins. You've got this. I opened my mouth and I began to sing. I am one voice and I am singing. If singing was something that made me so self-conscious, why was I doing this? I've thought about that over the years, and in hindsight, I think I've come to realize is that I knew that if any relationship that is good is a relationship in which people are willing to be vulnerable with one another. We need to be able to see each other's warts and wrinkles. We need to be able to be vulnerable with one another. If you are going to love me and I'm going to be able to love you. And outside of me dancing in the pulpit, whole nother story. Outside of me dancing in this pulpit, nothing would make me more vulnerable on that first Sunday than singing in the pulpit. Now, I share this with you because it connects in some ways to Peter's story of walking on water. And it's clearly not the same as Peter choosing to jump out of the boat and walk on the water in the midst of the stormy seas. Mine was a lot less impulsive than Peter's. I had shared the idea with a couple of folks. I'd even lined up some help for me down the line. But I do have a sense of what Peter's panic was when he first steps out on the boat, out of the boat, and he begins, and he in fact has his gaze focused on Jesus, and he is indeed walking on the water until he takes his gaze off and he looks around, and all of a sudden he realizes in fact that he is not out in a calm sea, he is not on dry land, he is in a place where the waves are raging, where the wind is blowing, and he begins to panic. That's exactly what happened as I began to sing those first notes. And even though it was just 8 words, I am one voice and I am singing, and took probably about 5 to 10 seconds. In that 5 to 10 seconds, there were at least a dozen conversations going on inside of my head. At least a dozen conversations just fighting with each other to be heard. David, what are you doing? Are you even on key? David, what are you doing? Do you even know the cadence of the song? David, you are hardly a singer. What do you think you're doing? David, this could well be the stupidest way to begin your time in the pulpit. David, you could step down right now, make a joke of it. No one would ever know that you actually meant to sing. No one would know. David, what are you doing? Inside, though it may not have shown on the outside, panic was welling up inside of me. My spirit had lost focus. I was being overwhelmed by the reality of that moment, in the same way that Peter, when all of a sudden he looks around and he sees waves that are about to take him under, wind that is about to blow him back. But then I did something. I turned towards the piano, and there was Don Conover. Angie was on vacation that first week that I was there. And Don looked at me with those loving eyes and that wonderful, kind face, a face that I had just met 2 days before for the very first time. And Don looked at me and he simply nodded. "You're all right," his eyes said, his nod said. "You got this." Like Jesus saying to Peter, "Do not be afraid." Most of the biblical commentaries on this story will focus very much on this interaction between Peter and Jesus. Robbie Hart in our lectionary group said it brilliantly. She said, it is the moment that Peter takes his focus off of Jesus that chaos ensues in his life. As long as he is focused on Jesus, he can do anything. And so metaphorically, this story, whether it's about walking on water or anything else, metaphorically, what this story tells us is a truth there. It is about where your focus is and where your focus should be. And that should go in two ways. On the one hand, when times are really tough, when panic is setting in, when chaos is surrounding us, are we focused on Jesus? Is his presence in our life? Is his call to love in our life? That is where our focus should be in those moments in our time of chaos and panic. But we also live in a world where indeed chaos and panic may be all around us. And the question then becomes, how can we be like Jesus was to Peter at that time, to one another? Are we able to, when friends and loved ones are in a place of fear, can we be the calming presence that allows them to begin to breathe again and calm down? When anger stalks our streets, can we be the loving presence that calls folks not to rage and revenge and retribution, but to reconciliation and restoration? When our whole world seems hell-bent on consuming itself into oblivion, can we be the people that we can be focused on to call us to a more balanced way of being, a Pono way of being in this world? In the story of that first Sunday for me, Don Conover was not just a kind face at the piano urging me on. Like Jesus, when he takes Peter's hand and prevents him from going any further under, Don then began to sing. "We are two voices, we are singing." And when Don began to sing, my pitch was easy to keep. When Don began to sing, my cadence was easy to maintain. The story does not say to us that when Jesus takes Peter's hand, he then starts going towards the boat, dragging Peter through the water. It doesn't say that Jesus reaches down and grabs a hold of Peter and carries him to the boat. It simply says that when they got into the boat, and I am utterly convinced that in the gospel writer's retelling of this story, whether he's telling a metaphor or reality as he remembers it, makes no difference there. Peter holds Jesus' hand, and as they are holding hands together and walking to the boat, Peter is walking on water once again. There with Jesus. Jesus is not doing all the work. They are there connected together. And again, most commentaries will focus on this interaction between the impulsive but utterly humanly full of foibles, Peter. Most commentators will forget that there are others in the boat as well. If you read the many commentaries about this story, you will read mostly about what does it mean that Peter begins to falter and Jesus says, do not be afraid, and grabs his hand and pulls him out. That's where the focus typically is. But you have to remember, there were others in this story as well. There were others who were on the boat at the time. You remember that they too, like Peter, had been on the boat all night. The story tells us where this story picks up in the gospel story is right after Jesus has fed the 5,000. He puts the disciples on a boat and sends them across the lake while he goes up into the mountains to pray. It is evening, we are told, when they get on the boat. And when they get on the boat, the winds begin to buffet them right then. The waves begin to pound them right then. And what we are told in the story, it is not until the early light of the morning that Jesus comes to them. That means from dusk until dawn, they have been beaten up by those waves and that wind. They have been in the midst of a chaos that felt like it might very well consume them. Kayla McClurg, in writing about this passage, takes the storm on the sea and she translates it into the very chaos of our lives. She writes, storms rage. Famine and flood bring waves of starvation and disease. Angry winds of partisanship and hate threaten entire systems of government. Isolation and mistrust destabilize neighborhoods. Addiction ravages families. This is the breeding ground of hopelessness and abandonment. But those disciples, in the midst of all of that chaos that they are experiencing there on the lake, in the midst of those waves and those winds, they are watching the scene unfold in front of them. In the same way that Peter is living it, they see Peter step on the water. They watch him miraculously walk. They watch him begin to fail. They hear Jesus say, be not afraid. They see Jesus take his hand. And then, in my mind's eye, as the gospel writer writes it, I see them utterly laser focused on Jesus at this moment. Utterly laser focused like a tracking beam, that now that they see him and now that they see him with Peter, it is as if they are bringing him to them as much as Jesus is walking towards them. And in that moment, what we are told is when Jesus steps into the boat, when he is welcomed into the fold of the disciples, when he is welcomed into that community there on the boat, it is at that moment that the chaos ends. Take a moment and look right now at those of us who are on the boat together. Push the button on your screen that says gallery view and scroll through page after page and look at the folks of the community that is on that boat together and ask ourselves, is the Holy One, is the very presence of love in the fold amongst us? Have we welcomed the Holy One into our collective presence? Have we allowed the one who is love to fully dwell amongst us? For the disciples, that is one of those moments where they come to realize what it means to be that beloved community. When the chaos is dissipated and calm prevails and the ministry continues, the boat sails to the shore, and there on the shore, there is a ministry of healing, of people in need of healing and presence that is right there waiting for them and Jesus. At that very moment when we can recognize that indeed we are that beloved community in which the presence of the Holy One dwells amongst us fully and completely, this is the moment when new options, impossible to imagine when we are feeling utterly buffeted by chaos and fear, will emerge. To borrow a phrase from the poet and writer Walida Imarisha, this is the moment in which we can be brave enough to imagine beyond the boundaries of what the world says is real and strong enough to do the hard work of sculpting reality from those dreams. to be brave enough to imagine beyond the boundaries of what the world says is real, and strong enough to do the hard work of sculpting reality from these dreams. What we know is that over time, experiences such as this on the boat will shape those disciples. In the days to come, when Jesus is no longer physically present with them, but when they have been unified by his very spirit, they will begin to change the world. They will declare to the world that there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, rich or poor, male or female, and they will live in that way. We are all one in the Holy One, the Christ, the presence of love. This is a most radical way to be, and they will begin to live that, and in so doing, begin to shift the very reality that the world has said is how it must be. And we, 2 millennia later, as inheritors of that faith, we are just as capable of a focused gaze on the presence of love. We are just as capable of such audacious dreams. Can we dare to imagine and then make real, for instance, as we have read about and heard about for a couple weeks, that an affordable housing project in Kailua will not only just pass the city council, as Faith Action is helping to do, but will indeed become a model for similar projects in every community, so that all have housing, regardless of their place of origin, regardless of their level of education, regardless of the importance of their title or the control of whatever possessions they have, that all will have housing. Can we dream and imagine that and then make it real? We can, as that beloved community. That is what we are being told. Can we imagine and dream that a pandemic that has made mincemeat of the very economic engine that has kept people in low-wage jobs to begin with for decades, for generations, that this pandemic becomes instead the impetus to a fairer, more just job market, one that makes a living wage possible for all? Can we imagine that? Can we dream that and then do the work to make it possible? That is what we are called to do. Can we imagine right here within our home, within our church community, that a fall fair, as Roger Watanabe has been guiding us to, that cannot be as it once was? We cannot gather together in Weaver Hall and have people pulling clothes left and right and gathered in close quarters. We can't do that right now. But that doesn't mean that the energies that go into the fall fair cannot instead be a vehicle for gathering in different ways, and a vehicle for raising funds that are not necessarily for ourselves, but for where the need is greatest in the community. Can we imagine and dream and make a reality of that? That is what we are called to do. For in the chaos and the panic that exists in the world, the fear that exists in our world, there is that moment in this story when their laser focus has welcomed Jesus into the fold, and at the moment when they welcome the loving presence of God into their community, that is the moment when calm ensues and the possibilities emerge. 156 Sundays ago, it wasn't just Don Conover who joined me in song. On the third verse, the choir members scattered amongst the congregation popped up and sang, "We are 10 voices, we are singing." And then at that moment, the congregation popped up, "We are 100 voices singing." And we became 10 million voices singing, until we sang together at the very end, "I am one voice and I am singing, I am not alone." We are not alone. We are a community. We are the beloved community that God has called us to be, echoing Psalm 133, such a moment of us singing together, "We are not alone," is a microcosm of the very reality of just how beautiful it is when kindred, when the beloved community dwells together in beauty and love. May we, even when we are presently faithfully distanced from one another, masked and ready to go, have our hearts open wide, our spirits ready to be engaged. May we reach to one another, invite the Holy One into our boat, and make of this world a place where heaven and earth can truly meet. Amen. Yes.